Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Today we were having a conversation at the afternoon tea time. There was a question about the relationship between habits. One of the first three fetters, called Silapata Paramasa, or attachment to rules and conventions, rites and rituals, or in a sense attachment to social agreements, things that we give value to. And then having given value or meaning or particular qualities to, then believing in those values, buying into that value system. So this can refer to, most often, say, in the scriptures, it refers to things like believing that if you bathe in the river Ganges, then you're going to be purified from all your bad karma, or if you recite certain mantras, that you're going to acquire particular powers or longevity or such like. But it's also, as many people are familiar with, refer to also many conventions of our life, what we think of as being beautiful or ugly, what we think of as being socially acceptable or unacceptable, appropriate or inappropriate. This is always an interesting and helpful area to reflect on, because all of us are conditioned by particular protocols, the conditioning of our nationality or our religious allegiance, our family, a particular social group that we feel part of. And that conditioning has a certain power. We have a feeling of importance that we give to things. We give value to here at Vayagiri Monastery, so the chanting that we do, sitting meditation, ways that we behave in relationship to each other, the monastics to lay people to monastics, senior to junior, so on and so forth. These are structures that we live with, and we develop certain habits, so that when I come in and to the hall and there's this sort of central mat here in front of the shrine. Ajahn Pasano is away in Ladakh at the moment, so there's just one cushion in front of the shrine. So according to our conventions, this is my cushion, my mat. And so if I come here and Venerable Kachana is sitting on my mat in front of the shrine, then I'm going to think, oh, that's very interesting. I wonder what Tan Kachana is doing on my mat. Maybe he's gone completely crazy, you know. It'll be an interesting evening. Because the convention is, well, that's the Ajahn's mat, that's where the Ajahn sits. But it's just a convention. You know, there's no particular reason why it has to be mine. It's not like every molecule of carbon and phosphorus and nitrogen and hydrogen and oxygen that's sort of woven into the cotton and kapok of this mat has got my name on it somehow. Or, 15 years ago, this was a garage. You know, there was a workbench here, and a dead Chevy, or at least a Chevy without an engine, sitting right in the middle of the hall, and a Kawasaki 900 over on the right, and a marijuana drying oven in the corner. Yeah, you know, we just shift the conditions around, change a few of the agreements and the protocols. Yeah. Adjust a few of the conventions, and now it becomes the Vayagiri Shrine Room. That's what it is. And in a number of years' time, when we built a new hall down here or a new hall up on top, then this will be the old Shrine Room that we don't use anymore. Just like the previous shrine room that we had is now the kitchen, you know, where the area of the house where there's the island with the granite top, that used to be the shrine room. And now where the kitchen counter is, some of the cupboards, that was where the shrine was, where that was used to be my seat. But it's not, it's just the kitchen counter now. So conventions come and go and they change. They have a relative importance. They have a value. It helps us to order our days. As Ajahn Chah would say, you know, the conventions have their purposes. We all have individual names. There's, you know, Amaro and Silananda and Karunadamo, Kachana, Kevin, Brian. You know, we have our names because, as Lumpo Cha would say, if we were all just called person, it would get really complicated. Say, well, this is person's seat, and that's where person sits, and person sits there, but person sits over there. And on this side, we've got person, 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 and person. It's kind of ridiculous, like the philosophy department of in that Monty Python sketch where everyone's called Bruce. You know, it's ridiculous. So we have, it's useful to have different names so we can distinguish which order we're supposed to sit in and who goes through the door first and who lives in which place and who's supposed to be giving the Dhamma talk on a Saturday night. So we have conventions, and then also the conditioning that we have, our own habits, our own, not just the social conventions, but our own body size, our gender, our accent, the shoe size that we have, the way that we walk, the patterns of thinking, whether we're extrovert or introvert, whether we're expressive or we're quiet. These are different habits and different styles. And these are our ordinary natural qualities of the human realm. But it becomes problematic for us, doesn't it, when we take those particular qualities and then turn them into an absolute value system, that this is right, this is, you know, people should be like me, they should talk quietly, or they should walk like, they should walk slowly, or they should walk carefully like me, they shouldn't walk like that, striding about. People should behave according to my preferred patterns of activity. They should sit in this particular way, they shouldn't sit in that way, they should be inspired by these particular teachings, and just like me, they should ignore these other particular kinds of teachings. And it's, in some ways, it's absurd when we spell it out like that. But isn't it interesting how we can judge other people for thinking in different ways that have different belief systems or different value systems, and the mind moves to saying, well, that's stupid, or that doesn't taste nice, or how on earth could they have cooked that, or like, or that's not how my mother used to make it. This is right, that's wrong, this is good, that's bad, this is beautiful, that's ugly. And we drift into judging those things in an absolute way. We make them into firm and fixed realities. And this comes from ignorance, doesn't it? It's the avijja is the root of that issue. That's the troublemaker. As Lumpo Samedo has often said in the past, you can most easily translate avijja paccaya sankhara as ignorance complicates everything. You know, when there's ignorance, then we don't see things clearly, and it creates that sankhara. It makes the world of things. And once you've got things, and you've got good, bad, right and wrong, this and that, here and there, self and other, those polarities, dualities become fixed, they become firm and solidified in our perceptions. Now, it's natural for us to have different habits. You know, I have a particular accent, of a particular way of thinking or walking, particular preferences, and so it's particular tastes and habits. You know, having grown up in England, like at tea time I was saying how, having grown up in England, when I taste Marmite, it's delicious. It's the stuff of life. It's happiness itself. Most Americans who encounter a Marmite in their adult life go, ugh, Do you guys eat this on purpose? Is he actually supposed to swallow this stuff? Like, for those of you who know Northeast Thailand, Marmite is like English pladek, like fermented, rotten fish sauce, fermented fish. It's a kind of powerful taste if you've grown up with it, because in England it's often the first food that you have after you've been weaned. Marmite, what they call Marmite soldiers, which is Marmite spread on little sticks of bread. So it's imprinted on the mind, on the whole being at an early age, so it becomes an intrinsic good. It's like peanut butter is in the USA. It's like I was a bit of an odd English person because I like peanut butter, but the rest of my family found it absolutely disgusting. And there used to be a rule in our family house that if there was peanut butter on the table, I had to keep the jar firmly closed and the lid screwed on, because my sisters in particular were just utterly revolted by it. Now, for most Americans, the idea that peanut butter could be revolting is like, what? How could peanut butter be revolting? It's the stuff of life. It's happiness. It's good. It's goodness itself. You know, we just imprint on particular tastes and flavors. It's just like for many Thai people, that when they have Western food, even if they go to a really posh restaurant with some kind of cordon bleu chef and three Michelin stars, then the experience is, my meal wrote no flavor, because it doesn't knock the roof of your mouth off. This is a sweeping statement, of course, but I have heard it has been expressed to me. Because it's not spicy, it might have what we would think of as those conditioned with a Western palate, a lot of extraordinarily delicious, interesting flavors, but because it's not spicy or it doesn't kind of clear out your sinuses on the way down, hasn't got a good afterburn to it, then no flavor. My mi rot, no flavor, i.e. no burn. So we're conditioned to these kind of perceptions. We have our own habits. And so that developing mindfulness around this enables us to see, well, this is my particular style or my particular habit. It's not an absolute reality. It's just conditioned to Theravada Buddhism, I think this is good, that's bad. That today is the observance day, it's our Sabbath, it happens to be a Saturday as well. So, you know, for one religious group, the Friday is a Sabbath day, for another, Saturday is Sabbath, for Christians, Sunday is a Sabbath. It's just an agreement, it's just a social convention. Now, if we take that to be absolutely true, then right there in that grasping of the convention, this is buying into silapata paramasa, into the attachment to conventions, to structures and rituals, and that in that grasping, in that adherence, right there we create dukkha, we create suffering. It's exactly in that. So when we develop mindfulness, if we really want to free the heart from the fetters, it's so crucial to see the habits of judgment and evaluation, and seeing that our assessments of good, bad, right and wrong, beautiful, ugly, these can only be convenient fictions. They are partial truths. They can only be like a working hypothesis. They can't be anything more than that. It's impossible for them to be absolutely true. And the heart that recognizes that can only be partially true. It's just a conventional reality. It can't be an absolute. Then the heart that recognizes that is the heart that knows the Dhamma, that knows the reality of things. One of the things that causes this attachment to conventions to have extra oomph is because the feeling of self gets woven into that. It's because there's a certain relish of... We love our own judgments, don't we? We really like our own opinions, our point of view. You know, well, if you ask me, or I think, but this is great. this is so inspiring, this is really good, I love this, I couldn't stand that, that's really bad, how could they do that? There's a relish, isn't there, when we buy into our judgments. We just isn't, I mean, I find that. It's like something goes, yes, I like that. And even if it's not conscious, we don't notice that. We are building along with that the conventions, the samuti satya, the conventional truths that we're buying into. Along with that, there's the development of self view, sakaya ditti, personality view, that it also slides in there as well, which is another of the of these fetters, the first of the three fetters. It slides in there, and we don't notice that. There's a kind of gratification. There's a satisfaction that comes with me having an opinion, me having a preference, me judging. Even if it's what we're judging is, I can't stand that, oh, that's terrible, how could he do that? That's wrong. Isn't that so? Isn't that there's a certain charge, a relish, that comes from taking a position. And we don't notice that. We it's so normal that we don't see that's what's happening. So this is what is called in Pali is ahankara, mamankara, and mananusaya, the creating of I am, made of ahankara. Ahang literally means I am. It's from the verb to be. Mamang means mine. Ahankara, made of I am. Mamankara, made of mineness. This is the mine feeling. This is mine. My opinion, my thought, my feeling, what I like. And then the mananusaya, the underlying tendency towards conceit. So these filter into our thoughts, our opinions, our judgments, our preferences, and help to concretize them. It's like when you mix into the hardener into the cement or into the glue, it's the stuff that makes the glue really really tough. You mix the ahankara and mamankara into the mix, and it really toughens up, hardens the concretization of our views and opinions, our judgments, our preferences, our likes and dislikes. So again, this is, if we really want to free the heart, it's important to recognize that relishing, that I-making and my-making, and how we are so prone to that. That's a way that those ordinary patterns of existence that relate to our body, our personality, our patterns of conditioning, that slides in and makes it, this is me, this is mine, this is who and what I am. This is how sakaya ditti, self-view, gets strengthened, and how we continually generate the causes for dukkha in our heart. And when we bring mindfulness to this area, when we really get to recognize the I making and my making feeling, we can begin to discern it as a quality to it, as a tangible texture. You can feel that I making and mind making habit. It can be discerned. You know, the feeling of self, the feeling of I, is just another feeling. You know, we tend to think of I am the doer, I am the thinker, I am the experiencer. But if we apply the meditation to look at that, we can discern the actual feeling of I-ness and mine-ness, me-ness, that's discernible. And the feeling of self is not self. The feeling of self, the feeling of I-ness and mine-ness, is just another formation that arises and ceases. It might tell you it's an absolute reality, that the ego is a permanent and fixed truth. But just like anything else, the feeling of I, me, mine, arises and passes away. It is just another formation in nature. And when we begin to discern that, then we're able to see the many areas of our life and our experience that filters in. So much of it is also to do with the actions that we take, the efforts that we make in relationship to the world, in relationship to other people, the way that we function. Yeah, because it's not just opinions and views and preferences, but it's also, it filters into the quality of action, what we do, how we work, how we speak, the way we relate to other people. So it filters into that as well. So this is what we refer to in Buddhist teachings as the becoming tendency, bhava, the urge to become, bhava tanha, that relish that comes with the buying into the I feeling, the mind feeling. This is bhava tanha, the desire to be, the desire to exist. This is one of the qualities that the Buddha outlined as being a direct cause of dukkha. You know, often when we think of the cause of suffering, where it's outlined as desire, and we think of a desire for sense pleasure, for beautiful things to see and hear and feel and smell and taste and touch. That when we think of desire or craving, that's usually sense desire that gets the all the attention, because it's something that's much more dramatic or graphic, it's something that's much more visible and tangible, obvious. But for anyone who's practiced meditation very much and looked at how the mind works, you begin to realize that it's the other two kinds of desire, the two, in a way, the more subtle partners of sense desire, the other two kinds of craving that the Buddha outlined as being the cause of suffering, bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. The desire to become, the desire to be, and the desire to get rid of, to annihilate, the desire for annihilation. These are a much more insidious, but oftentimes much more difficult qualities to work with. But once we recognize them and see them and understand how they are, how they work, then it can be a tremendous benefit. A tremendous blessing in providing, bringing a genuine freedom of the heart. Tomorrow I'm due to be leading a workshop, a day-long meditation at Spirit Rock, and the theme is on compassion in action. And what I thought to use for the theme of the day, actually the title of the day, is from this particular aphorisms that were used by our friend Kandanya Barry Kapke, who was one of our Vayagiri's lay ministers. He passed away a couple of years ago now. But after he died, there was this woman who was a former student of his had written a letter to be read out at his funeral that we had in December of December 2008. And she said there were these three aphorisms that Kandanya used to use in teaching his students, because he was a teacher of various kinds of massage therapy and body work, and he used a lot of Buddhist meditation and Buddhist principles in relationship to his other kinds of therapeutic teaching. And so these were: don't push, just use the weight of your own body. Don't diagnose, just be aware. Don't try to help, but don't turn away. Now, this can seem to be pretty paradoxical. Or, well, you know, how do you do that? Or what's the point of that? But when you reflect on that, or looking at that, to me what that's a lot to do with is learning how to work without the heart being confused by the habits of becoming. So don't push, just use the weight of your own body. Don't diagnose, just be aware. Don't try to help, but don't turn away. Say when we are in a situation where we're trying to do something, we're exercising following an intention, we're exercising some choice to act, to do something. What often happens is that we meet with an obstacle, or something's in we perceive as something is in the way, and we want to get over this obstacle in order to get to that good place in the future. We want to get rid of this problem, so we'll get to this nice place where there's me without the problem, me without the obstacle. At least that's how my mind often works, and it's the same for many of us, I would guess. And the more difficult or intense the obstacle, the more keen we are to push past this, to get over this, to get this out of the way, so we can get to this imagined beautiful and fine place on the other side. We imagine, wouldn't it be nice not to have this this injury? Wouldn't it be nice not to have this difficult relationship? Wouldn't it be nice not to have this criticism that I'm receiving? Wouldn't it be nice not to have this physical problem or this emotional problem? And we create this image of me who can sit on the floor in full lotus, me who hasn't got this big debt to pay off, me who hasn't got this difficult squabble between my siblings, or me who hasn't got this difficult conflict. And we create an image off somewhere in the distance, and then we find ourselves pushing towards that, or just aiming our intentions at that. And the more difficult, the more painful things are, the more we tend to create this fantasy image of a future where I won't have that, and wouldn't it be nice? And so what this kind of principle is pointing to is that this is the guaranteed way to create more becoming, that you're putting the quality of happiness and goodness over there someplace. It's not here, it's there. Goodness, reality, happiness is over there. And the more that we create a promising there, the more we miss what's here. We are filling the mind with an imagined there, an other, and we're missing this. We miss the reality of what's present, what's in our own hearts, what's the actuality of this moment. So that when we are caught up in that quality of becoming, when that is, say, the dominant feature, then it can also be that we are desperately trying to help. We want we're not just our own, getting over our own difficulties, pushing through our own difficulties to get to some pleasant future. It can be others, that someone else that we're with is suffering and we want to help them. But we can take such a situation and think, oh, I want to be able to help this person to get healed, or to get clear of this difficulty, or so they wouldn't be suffering this problem, so they would be happy. And again, we create this hoped for future, and then we find ourselves so desperate to help them, we actually miss the real person. we're so busy focusing on how we want them to be that we just actually built the barrier between ourselves and the person who's right with us, who's right before us, and that in our efforts to help, to do the right thing, to be of benefit, we're actually creating more dislocation. We're creating a greater sense of alienation, of distance, and thereby being less mindful, less attuned to what's really present and what's really useful. So that's why these principles of, don't push, just use the weight of your own body. It's like, rather than pushing and having a goal in mind and just aiming at that, just to lean or to incline and say, okay, yes, there's work that needs to be done, there's effort that needs to be applied, but let's apply it in respect to what's actually here. Let's keep the attention on what's here, not some imagined future over there. Let's apply the effort, but apply it in accord with the actuality of what's needed. So you you're certainly doing, there's certainly an application of energy and effort, but it's attuned to the actuality of what's present. In trying to help, so as you said in that, rather than being fixated on our wish to relieve the other's suffering or our compulsion to be helpful. Because sometimes helping others is just a way of exercising our own need to feel useful and good and to be appreciated. It can just be actually, you know, sometimes our helpfulness can be more our own need to be appreciated and liked and loved. And the other person is just a kind of bit player in our need to be a useful person. And as I often quote, well-known English theologian and writer C.S. Lewis, talking about good works in the Anglican Christian world, saying that it is indeed the duty of every good Anglican to be of benefit, to seek out and help those who are in need. But unfortunately, some of those who are in need have about them the look of the hunted. All these sort of good-hearted people trying to do good works, looking for some suitable, not exactly victim, but you know, possible beneficiary. So you just become a bit player in someone else's need to be a useful and good person. So if we want to be helpful, he said, don't try to help, don't try to fix, just be aware. So then by being aware, then we're paying attention to the situation, we're paying attention to this moment, and really feeling out, okay, what's useful here? And then the degree to which help can be given, or that which can be that which is able to be fixed, is fixed. That's coming from an attunement to the actual need, the situation that's being experienced, rather than our own need to be needed or to be useful or to play a particular role, or just again heading towards a fixed idea off in the future that is just off in our imagination, that's not connected to the reality of here and now. And then the last one, yeah, or the third of these, don't diagnose. Sorry, you know, don't diagnose, just be aware. Don't try to help, but don't turn away. These are all, you know, reflecting the same principles that the urge to fix or to help, to diagnose, to have too much investment in an intellectual idea, in an intellectual assessment. Oh, I know what's going on. I understand this. I know what's happening here. And to be able to not jump in and have a fixed idea or a fixed belief about what's going on in anyone's situation. To be able to say, well, I don't know, or well, maybe it's this. That quality of awareness is bringing an attunement to the present moment, and what that attunement can bring is often a sense of, I don't really understand what's going on here, or I don't see the whole picture. And the urge to diagnose, to judge, to fix in a concept can just be getting in the way. So when we are we're looking at these principles, we're looking at that becoming urge co-opting our abilities to really benefit ourselves, to benefit others. That readiness to eagerness to sort of to be and to do and to head towards a particular goal. There's a relish to that. There's a gratification that's in that, but it's a direct cause of suffering also. So it might be easy to think, well, these kind of principles are talking about being passive or not caring. But as Kundanya would put it, it's don't try to help, but don't turn away. So that you're letting go of that urge or that agitated quality of got to do something, but just trusting in the quality of awareness, of bringing mindfulness and wisdom to the situation, then that very attention, that very presence, guides our actions, guides our attitude. We're able to bring a clear and peaceful presence, and then our own activity, our own actions, our own intentions arise from that quality of mindful awareness. So in essence, what we're doing and we're talking about here is learning to recognize the becoming urge, bhava tanha. Recognizing that, getting to know that, the feeling, the quality of that, and learning to let go of that desire, just even though it's much more subtle than sense desire, karma tanha, it's equally a cause of dukkha. To recognize that, and also then its partner, vibhava tanha, the desire to switch off, like, well, it's not my problem, I don't care, or whatever. That desire to get rid of, to not feel, to not be, to just ignore. And similarly, it's recognizing that dismissive, negative, nihilistic urge. Recognizing that. And similarly, it's a subtle but pervasive presence. And when we get to know those, then we're able to truly cultivate right action, right effort. Now, it's also curious, and I often comment on this or reflect on this, that when we look at the causes of dukkha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, are very much the cause of suffering, cause of dukkha. But then we might ask, well, if we're trying not to become or trying to let go of the desire to get rid of, how do we do anything? Shouldn't we want to become concentrated? We want to become kind. We want to become compassionate. We want to get rid of our selfish thoughts. We want to get rid of our defilements. Isn't that right? Don't we want to become good things? Don't we want to get rid of unwholesome things? But if you look at the quality of right effort, samavayamo, in the Eightfold Path, the Buddha defines this in very distinct ways, that the four factors of right effort, the restraining of the unwholesome from arising, sangvara, the restraint, pahana, letting go of the unwholesome if it has arisen, bhavana, the cultivation of the wholesome, bringing the wholesome into being, anurakana, the protection, the cherishing of whatever wholesomeness has arisen. So that can seem very like, well, isn't that the same as wanting to become concentrated, wanting to become kind, wanting to develop goodness, wanting to get rid of the unwholesome, wanting to restrain the unwholesome from arising? And at a superficial view, looking at it superficially, it can feel that way, it can seem that way. But and even in their names, like bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, you have bhava is the ailment, it defines the illness, but bhavana, or cultivation, development, is what we're supposed to do in relationship to the Eightfold Path. It should be developed. Bhavana is a synonym for meditation, for cultivation, for development. So right there, you have the two, you have the ailment and the poison and the cure, the ailment and the recovery, have extremely similar names, bhavana and bhava. But it's rather like medicines, that sometimes the cure is just made from the medicine is made from the poison, like homeopathic remedies. In order to have the cure, you use the poison, the troublemaker. So that the difference between the two, and what makes them actually opposite to each other, one's the cause of the problem, the other's the cure of the problem, is that right effort, the restraining of the unwholesome from arising, the letting go of the unwholesome once it's arisen, the cultivation of the wholesome, the maintaining and being of the wholesome, that when it's right effort, there's no sense of self involved. It's not me restraining the unwholesome. It's not me letting go of the unwholesome. It's not me cultivating the wholesome, developing the wholesome. It's not me maintaining the wholesome in being. There's no sense of I or me or mine in right effort. So that they can look like each other, right? You know, like a poison oak and a real oak. The, you know, the leaves can look just like each other, but one is poisonous and the other and will give you a rash for 2 or 3 weeks and make you itch like crazy, and the other is benign and is produces acorns and feeds a lot of the creatures in the forest. So they look like each other, poison oak and real oak. The leaves can look very, very similar, but they're totally different species. They have very opposite effects. So similarly, bhava and bhavana, the cultivation of right effort and the habits of becoming the desire to become, the desire to get rid of, they can look like each other, but they're completely different. But just like poison oak, you have to. Once you lived at Abhayagiri for a while, you get to know it pretty quick. once you've got the rash, you get very mindful. But in meditation, it can be harder to discern it. With our practice, it can be harder to recognize. So that's why it's really most essential just to get to know in the meditation using wise reflection to get to know the texture, the feel of becoming, the texture, the presence of the I am, me, me-ness, I-ness, ahankara, mamankara. And the more we get to know these, the more we recognize that quality and then learn to let go, to abandon that. Then, you know, the more that we're able to genuinely develop the path, the right effort can really be applied in an effective way. So then our efforts to help ourselves, the efforts to help others, can bear great fruit, can genuinely be a benefit. We know when our efforts are well applied, when to do something, when to act, and when to leave things alone. And if it is time to act, is what is the most beneficial and helpful means of acting. It becomes clear to us because the heart is not clouded by avijja. There's no compulsions and self-centered perceptions that obscure the picture. So, I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Mm-hmm.